Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Remy and Dan's High School Reunion Podcast, brought to you by PV Electronics. We love you, PV.
Love
you so much. Today, we had the pleasure of chatting with Tim DeKay.
American actor. You've seen him in a multitude of things. He was a series regular in Carnival, White Collar, but also a number of film and Seinfeld, Friends, you name it. I mean, I can go on and on.
Just check his IMDb page, guys. It'll be a lot easier for you. But we had a fantastic conversation with him, and we really hope you enjoy. So
we had so much fun.
Yeah, have a good listen, guys. All righty, Remy, take us off. Take us off.
Take us off where?
Take us off. You know. Take us. Take us wherever.
I know. I'm so excited.
You are excited. So take the lead. Go for it, girl.
So sitting next to us is the amazing, the incomparable Tim DeKay.
Yeah.
Wow. I'll take those two words. I got to say right now, you had Harry Lennox on here, right?
Yes.
So Harry and I did a play reading. They do these great play readings. They're called readings in the canyons or something like that. And they're staged readings of plays, and it's by tree people. So I thought, great. Yeah, I'll do one with Harry. And he and I had the leads. Harry has a photographic memory. So in this, you rehearse for a week and then you put it on.
Uh-huh.
On day two, Harry was coming in with no script.
Oh,
meanwhile,
man.
I had a script. I don't have a photographic memory. And I'm thinking, but it's okay because it's a reading. But then I realized, oh, no, I can't be the guy with the script and Harry not with the script. So I had to cram that whole week.
Was it a two-hander?
No. There were other cast members, but he and I had the bulk of the of the show. And I said, that's not nice, Harry. That's not.
You can't show me up like that.
Yeah,
man.
That's not being a team player. It's inappropriate.
Oh, my God.
Wait, so you actually, did you cram that entire week and you were completely off book by the end?
Here's what happened. Harry finally said, you know what, maybe we should both hold the scripts. And so we did. But, of course, he never referred
to it at all. Yeah.
So he was a team player. He was to be nice to you.
Yeah, and he's a great enough guy that I could, you know, give him, can we say shit on the on the buck?
We can able do, to give say him whatever shit. We want.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's my first story.
Do you remember I was going to have you and Harry on doing a short film that I did back in 2006?
I do remember that.
And I can, but you were both on series, and I couldn't get you on the same day. We just needed you for 2 days, but the thing is, I can get you on one day and him on the other. But you had scenes together,
and we couldn't do it.
And we couldn't.
That was smart of you to hire Harry because.
And you.
He has a photographic memory.
Yeah. We're going to talk about this.
That's it.
Just, we're just going
only
to talk that. About the, yep. you know, yep. how does a photographic memory occur? You know, we'll talk about that sort of stuff.
I have a good memory. I wouldn't say I have a photographic memory.
I have an okay memory. Actually, it's pretty terrible.
You have a pretty terrible memory.
I have
memory.
A pretty terrible memory. It takes me a while to get my lines in, but once they're in, boom, they're in.
They're in.
Yeah, they're in.
He loses them a day later.
Yeah.
My memory is all right. What I can't remember are the names of the characters I've played.
Oh, interesting.
But somebody shed some light to me on that. In that, you never say your own name. I mean, if you're of the character you're playing. So
yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. I'll give myself a pass on that one.
But. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, that's food for thought. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
It is interesting.
I could name a lot of characters that I've been in scenes with.
Yeah.
But I couldn't name my...
Do they say your, character name a lot, though? Or not too much?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Maybe I'm not listening when they say my name, my character's name. I don't think so, no.
No.
I don't think so. I'm
questioning my entire life existence right now.
I've taken away that pass.
Yes.
Are you acting on your own, Harry?
Yeah. Back to Harry Lennox.
Yes. I just had to get Tim. Sorry, I just called you Harry.
No, a lot of people mistake us for the same person all the time.
I was going to say, when you came in, I was like, didn't we interview you the other day? I mean, this is just getting a little bit weird.
Often.
I just have to quickly ask, you said tree people.
Yeah.
What? Are they, you know, people in trees?
Oh, you don't know tree people?
I don't know tree people.
Oh, it's this great organization.
Okay, I thought it was like you do stuff in trees and things like that, which would have been awesome.
They probably do.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a wacky bunch of people, but a huge organization now. And they basically, their mission is to plant trees in L.A. County.
Okay, cool.
And they have a headquarters up at the top of Coldwater and Mulholland, mm-hmm. and you can walk around there, and elementary kids always go there and have field trips. And it's a great organization. Yeah. And you can give a tree in as a gift to somebody in their name. And
that's cool.
Yeah. They just go around planting trees.
Any particular types of trees or?
You name it.
Yeah.
You name it.
Oh, wow.
An elm. Maybe if you want to.
Okay, that's nice.
A maple?
Sure.
A palm? Sure. Palm tree, yeah.
Yeah. There's a few. I don't think they do palms.
No? I mean, there's too many palms in LA.
There are a lot of palms, and they don't. I think.
They're not native to. Are they native to?
No.
No, no, no.
And also, I think they're looking for more trees that can give off oxygen.
Oxygen, yeah.
I mean, this is a desert.
It is.
I think the cactus is indigenous of Los Angeles.
Right? Yeah, that's about it. And the. But some others do well here.
Yeah.
So we're talking about trees.
We're talking about trees.
This is where the conversation has gone from photographic memories to trees.
I love it.
It is fantastic. So how do you two know each other?
How do we know each other? I mean, how did it start?
You know what? I've been trying to remember, and I think I asked you this once.
Photographic
how
memory.
We mm-hmm. met. No, because I can remember how I met almost everybody, but I remember when I first met you person to person, but I don't remember how we were introduced to each other. And I want to say it was a referral of some sort.
I tried to think of who referred us, and I couldn't think of it.
Me neither, but I definitely remember.
Many moons ago.
Like, it's not that long ago.
Yes.
Come
you
on.
You were four. No, I was seven.
He was my babysitter.
Yeah.
Which is kind of odd because I was only seven at the time, but I'm very mature.
Very, very mature. Yeah.
Actually, I think, was Dana or James seven at the time?
Dana, very James good. Children. Very good, Romy. I don't know. They were young.
Young.
Very young. And now they're 16 and 19.
Oof.
Dana's tall.
Dana's 5'9". Yeah. She's beast. She's a volleyball beast.
Nice, nice. Like beach or the indoor?
No, she doesn't like beach.
No?
She doesn't like beach at all. In fact, she loathes it.
Interesting.
But yes, we do indoor.
Yeah, my brother was a beach volleyball player, and then he ended up
just... Oh, he was?
Yeah. He was training to get into the Australian Olympic team.
Oh.
But then he just stopped, and he realized, it's not for me. It's not what I want to do.
It's tough.
Yeah.
How old was he when he realized that?
Oh,
last year?
No. He is 20 something years old, I think.
Mid 20s, somewhere.
Yeah, something like that. Because a lot of, especially beach volleyball, they're much older.
Yeah.
Like I've noticed that a lot of the world champions are like almost 40 or 35.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I might be completely wrong, but I remember when I'd go and watch his events and things like that. A lot of the really top players were much older. For some reason, there's some kind of maturity.
There is, and it's a huge game of angles.
Yeah.
And so you can use your energy wisely, but still, you got to be in top shape.
Yeah, on the sand. My God.
But the whole idea. Oh, yeah. No, to play volleyball in the sand, to me, is like playing volleyball in a nightmare. I can't quite get to that ball.
Yeah,
you know, I can't quite run from that monster.
Well, it's hard to run in the sand.
It is.
Really tough. I grew up alongside the beach, the shore, the Jersey Shore, and it was tough.
Yeah.
Your calves. But in answer to Dan's question, I can't remember. No, but I remember going to your house. Tim was my acting coach.
Hey.
He started off as my acting coach.
Yeah. That was many, many moons ago.
Yeah, 2006, 2005.
Wow.
Somewhere around that area, in that time frame. But what I do remember, and we must tell Dan the story about how I remember one time I came and I just went right through. The studio was in the back of the, it was a separate.
Yeah. It was a detached garage.
Yeah, detached garage. But you had a really nice, you wouldn't have guessed, it was a really nice office and space. And so I went right through, didn't see Dana, who was his, I don't know how old she was at the time. And then I went through, and apparently, and you take the story from here, she was crying.
She was crying, yeah, because you're like, uh-oh, you didn't stop in and say hello.
I didn't see her.
Rummy.
Yeah.
I would have.
She didn't say hi.
So, and so I guess Lisa, your wife, I guess she's the one who popped her head in, had a word with you, and then you left, and then you came in carrying Dana, and she goes, Dana. I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Did she say anything to you? Well, I remember going back inside, and she was concerned that you would know she was crying, and she didn't want that.
Oh, I didn't know this part.
Because that's not being a cool, mature young woman. I don't know. She was maybe 3 or 4, but, you know, that's the thing about, it's just, my wife's an actress, too. And we came out here in 95, and the amount of, not the amount, yeah, there were a large amount, but the kind of friends that would come to our house and the kind of people that we know through acting.
Yeah.
The kids never saw them as, oh, the grown-ups that were intimidating. Yeah. They were these animated, and still are, wonderful, engaging children as well. You know, all actors.
Yeah,
there's a childlike quality that we have to have in all of us, I think, to try and make a living pretending.
Because I assume they would all like interact in a very childlike way with all the kids and things like that.
They come over and it was fun and they loved it because, and they still do because it's, you know, wacky actors coming into the house. And so for them, it was never an intimidating thing.
Yeah.
Every so often we throw an accountant or somebody like that into the dinner
party. Who is this guy? Yep. Who is this girl?
No, and they would find them interesting because they were different.
Yeah. They would be different, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Definitely. But I just felt awful. But it really was. I hadn't seen her. So I breezed right on through. Yeah. She didn't like that. And I was like, Dana, I'm so sorry. Of course I would have, you know, stopped and said hi to you. Like, oh, I didn't see you. So it was so sweet.
Would she do the same thing if Romy popped over and didn't say hello? Yeah.
She's not an angry teen, thank goodness. But
I don't think she'd remember me.
Maybe not. But she would say hi, have a bit of a conversation with you, and then she'd be off because she is 16 and in high school, and I feel like I'm chasing her. Wait, where are you going?
Yeah, be safe. Don't.
Yeah,
because I remember all that from my little sister because I was 15 when my little sister was born. And so I remember the majority of her life. And when she turned 16, I just remember, I just like, she didn't act out, but she was, you know, out with all the girls all the time and all this sort of stuff. You know, that little rebellious teen kind of a thing. I think she rebelled more than like her three older brothers. So,
were you involved in any sports or anything?
Yes. So back in Australia, when I was younger, I athletics. I played cricket. I played rugby league, rugby union. Let's see. I did a little bit of basketball, played a little bit of volleyball at school. But my main love was rugby league. And then because I was born with a heart condition and I had to get a pacemaker. And when I was 17, I had to just stop all that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So, but I, when I look back on it, I wasn't good enough to be like, go to the next higher level, but I just love playing it. And I just love watching sport and all that sort of stuff.
So do I.
And I think I can do that. That's my thing. Just watch.
And I think, guys who are involved in sports, or maybe they're in a band at school. Same with gals. You have that connection. You immediately have a social group.
Yeah, exactly.
And my daughter has that with some of her volleyball teammates. I find that she knows exactly what she's going to do this coming weekend. Exactly. if you asked my son what he was going to do this coming weekend, back when he was 16, I don't know. And then...
But then something would come up.
Something would come up, but
yeah.
I think that's the big difference between men and women, though. Women are planners. Yes. We need to plan. Yes. And guys are so off the cuff.
I was exactly. very much the same as your son. Mm-hmm. I would be like, let's do something.
Very much the same as Dan, except I usually had nothing going on because I didn't. Well, I was a bullied kid. I didn't have friends.
Were you really?
Really?
No, I didn't have friends.
Why was that?
I mean,
not that you did anything.
I was, I went to a very posh school and we were new. They didn't like outsiders. It wasn't a racial thing because there were lots of Asians there.
Yeah.
It was more, I think I was just new. I wasn't, my family wasn't as wealthy as some of the other, I mean, 16-year-olds driving Ferraris. This is what I'm talking about.
What?
I was driving a Honda Accord. Okay. And that was because my mom had
gotten style.
Yeah.
It was, no, but.
What color?
It was a tan or beige. Or,
nice.
Yeah. So it was a, you know, and all these, I mean, you should see the cars in the school parking lot. I mean, they were definitely nicer than the teachers' cars. Yeah. And I just remember 14, it's like Louis Vuitton, you know.
That happens.
And God forbid you wear the same outfit, you know, more than once in a school year. They would crucify you.
This fascinates the hell out of me because at school for us, virtually no one had cars. Like, I don't know if we just graduated a year earlier. What year do you guys get your driver's license and stuff like that?
No, 16.
16. Yeah. You get your license and you graduate.
17, 18?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's around about the same age for us as well. I think we're like 16 and a half. You can get your learner's license. And then I think you have to drive for a year or something like that before.
Oh, so you're about a year behind us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we can get our provisional license, which when you get your provisional license, you can drive your car by yourself. But there are certain rules. Like I think there's a there's curfew or something like that because
so many
new drivers have done stupid things and you can't have like three kids in the back or something like that.
Yeah.
There's all these new rules now, but it wasn't necessarily like that when I was driving, when I first started driving. But because so many young kids have been like, in accidents and things like that, they've increased the laws and stuff like that. But as I was saying, no Ferraris, no nothing like that. But obviously, I didn't go to a school like that.
But I did go
to a private boys' school, but nothing like that.
This was a public school.
What?
It was a public school in New Jersey. Let's put it this way: we used to go trick or treating at Bruce Springsteen's.
You did.
A house. You know, Bon Jovi was a
Why aren't
a
you
neighbor.
On this podcast telling stories?
Yeah. I don't.
Because
I,
I'm trying
I'm
to keep my...
Leaving my mic.
Yeah. So, but that was so, you know, in a big, you know, if I'm allowed to say, big mafia town as well. A lot of mafia. Some really famous mafia names, which I'm not going to drop here, but they're super famous.
Tony Soprano.
Yeah.
For one.
Yeah.
I'm talking
Don
about
Corleone.
Real
Oh,
mafia.
Real ones, not pretend.
Not pretend, okay. Real ones.
Did they have kids at school, at the school?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm just fascinated as hell by all that.
It was fascinating. I didn't even know what the mafia was at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, to go back to I was just an outsider.
Oh, gotcha. That's right.
I was an outsider. So by the end of my, of high school, I was just a little bit invisible and I was happy with that.
Yeah. Were you an outsider just purely based on the wealth, or was it? Did you come from somewhere? Like, what was considered an outsider?
New to the town.
Okay.
My mom actually moved to this town so I can go to this high school, and it was because scholastically we were one of the tops in New Jersey. So I just remember something like the top 50% all went to like Ivy Leagues or top tier schools, 50% of the class. And so if you had a B average, you can get into a place like Georgetown.
Oh, nice. Because it was that reputable school.
It was that reputable a school. So we were advanced. And apparently, and now my nephew and niece go to the school. It's even more competitive. Where it's actually the valedictorians were tied with each other. They both had like a 5.0 or something. And they didn't know who to give the...
They had an MMA battle?
Yeah, that would have been fun.
That would have been awesome.
And so they had
the principal comes up to both.
That would have been great.
All right, kids.
It was based on extracurricular activities. Who had more? And so it was. That was the only way they could break the tie.
It's a lot of pressure on kids.
No kidding. Yeah, like, there's a ton of pressure.
Like, all right, you know, so the following year after that, all right, we could both end up with the same grades. So therefore, we have to do as many extracurricular activities as possible. And the poor kids would just be exhausted.
We have to be there's a great documentary called Race to Nowhere.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these kids in these very competitive high schools, be it private or public, they're these kids are racing to get good grades, but the documentary talked about how many of these kids are not, the comprehension of everything is not truly setting and sitting inside them. And the name of the documentary came from a kid who said, I don't know, I just feel like I'm studying all the time. I'm up till late hours, but I'm not really learning anything. I'm just learning how to get good grades. I feel like I'm racing to nowhere.
But does she feel like we are kind of racing to nowhere? I mean, different for you because you have a family. And I get that you have a responsibility. You want to do well for your children. But sometimes I feel like, what is this all for?
Our career or just life?
Just life. No, our careers. Because it's at the end of the day, you know, my father died when I was two. And he worked a lot. But he did not talk about how he wished he could have worked more and made more money for the family. Mm. He wished he could have spent more time with us, actually. And I hear this, and I lost a very close girlfriend. She was a makeup artist, and she was in her mid-30s when she died of cancer. And I remember she was saying, I can't wait to eat. I'm never going to diet again. I'm going to have more fun. She was a workaholic, and she goes, I'm going to have more fun. I'm going to say yes to these exciting adventures that I just, you know what I'm saying? It's like she realized the value of life, and I hear this a lot now from people who have had near-death experiences. They change their outlook completely.
As I get older, I ask myself, okay, what's this for? What is this about? It's very easy to turn to your children and say it's about them. It's about tomorrow, which it is to a great degree. But yet you want to stay present and be present. So I found myself finding that balance of you live your whole, at least I have, I've lived my whole life in so many ways, wanting to make sure I make money, wanting to make sure I
provide,
can provide for just myself. I think maybe because of, I was brought up by depression era parents who were great, but money was important. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a salesman. But so once you've got kids and you're making what you thought was a good living, it's still not enough, and you want to keep going. And I found myself balancing that with, wanting to make money, but yet wanting to do what I feel is right and feels important, and somehow maybe can make the world better. I grapple with that all the time, all the time.
It's interesting.
It is. And speaking of, I have to bring this up. Speaking of depression era, Tim told me a story very early on when we met, which has resonated with me to this day. It's a story that I teach. I tell the kids, you know, the students I coach, not just kids, actually only have
just
16
walking
year old.
Past kids like, hey, I'm going to tell you a story. Yeah.
You don't know me.
Yeah. You don't know. I'm going to tell
depression.
the depression. Tim told me a story about going in to see a casting director, and it was the turning point of your career. You had seen a casting director, and that he's looking at me like, what are you talking about?
Where's this going?
All right, let me remind you. He went in for a casting, and he didn't book that part. I don't even know if he got called back. I don't think you did. And then 2 years later, he gets called in. He doesn't see the casting director for 2 years, and then the casting director then calls him in for something and says, I think you might be right for this.
Mm. Are we talking about Carnival?
We're talking about Carnival.
Yeah.
And he booked it.
Boom.
And that was your series regular, and it was set in the Depression. But please tell us the story.
Romy just told it. No, not at all. Yeah, I think, look, that's a lesson for certainly actors to know. We tend to cast ourselves or don't cast ourselves in things. I'll read a script and I'll say, yeah, I put myself in that. Sometimes I'll read a script and I wouldn't cast myself. And then what's worse is you go to the waiting room and in walks, I've had friends walk into the waiting room of a casting and I look at them, I say, you're my idea for this role. And it's true. I've also had times where I'll be in the waiting room and another actor will come in and say, shit, DK's here. But as you get older, you feel like you become much better at whether or not you should be cast in something or not. Mm. Anyway, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't ever go into a room without giving 100%.
Yeah.
And embracing it and enjoying it. Because you never know. And in this case, it was a couple of years later, and the person said, you gave a great audition for, I don't know what the project was. And she said, you weren't right for that, but I remembered you. And I think you're right for this.
You know? That's a good memory for 2 years.
And what was amazing is that I've been telling the story, and the same thing happened to me around last September. And Tim, I told you this.
Yeah,
that
you did.
I went for a casting, and I thought I bombed because I could hear a casting give other people notes. And then I went in, they hardly looked at me, and I went out, just the thank you. Not even, well done. Not even a pat on the back. I was just out. And I remember calling my agent saying, I did my best, but I said they didn't like me. I said, I bombed that. And then only to have them check my availability for a series regular for something about a year and 3 months later.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was absolutely sure they'd made a mistake. And I had my agent call them because I said they it must be a different Romy Park.
Was this Commander in Chief?
No. This is last year.
This is just last
year. I guess I didn't tell you.
No, you didn't. Thanks.
Okay.
Appreciate
yeah.
that.
Well, I told him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so and she said the exact same thing. She goes, "No, we loved her. We did it. We haven't made a mistake. It is her. She read for this.
Right.
She wasn't right for the part, but we think she's right for this." And it was. I was delighted.
But that also is a sign of a great casting director.
Yes.
Somebody who
And
can
she is a great casting director.
Because there are other casting directors out there. You can go out there and you give 100% and you'll never get that 2 years later or a year later saying, hey, I remember you. No. Mm. There are some who do and some who don't. And it's funny, as the years go on, the same casting directors seem to pop up in my career as time goes on.
Yeah, no, that's kind of true. Like I do have like a certain set of casting directors that I see quite frequently.
Right.
And I love actually going and seeing them because I'm comfortable. Mm. They know what I do. I know what they do. I know what the room's like. It's really good. And then you'll get some, you know, random new one that you kind of go in and it's just an uncomfortable kind of feeling.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like sometimes they are trying to prove themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it comes across as kind of like a very dismissive of like, oh, you're an inconvenience to us.
This is how powerful I am.
Yeah.
You're an inconvenience.
Yes, exactly.
That's when you have to take control of the room.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a never ending battle for me. Just, you know, just going to the room and just kind of go, no, I'm here. No, I'll do what I want to do. And, you know, or how about we work together instead of you.
That's why you invited me. So let's do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
My perception changed when I started doing some producing work. And that's when I think I said this in Harry's interview, or was it Harry's? But my perception just switched. And
it was Bruce's, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And then I just realized, you know, no. I understand now how a film gets made and how I'm probably the least important person.
Actor. Oh, it's the last thought.
The last thought.
We've got this, we've got that, everything, boom, boom, boom. And my image of that are producers, just creating everything for a movie that is needed months in advance.
Years, months.
And it's the night before, and they all look at each other. Oh, shit. We got to cast this thing. Oh, that should be too hard. And yeah. You need to just flip through some photos.
Have a name on a list.
Yeah.
Who can we get on schedule?
That's I always get like, that feeling.
Like names on a dartboard. And boom.
Well, you wouldn't believe that the way some producers talk. Oh, this actor, you know, oh, they haven't worked for a while. They'll do a schedule F because it's all about money at the end of the day. Yes. It could be a fine actor, but, you know, but they know who's been working and who's not working.
Oh, yeah.
And who will take a $1 million check as opposed to a $65,000 check. Yep. And so, but it's their job. They are problem solvers, but it always comes down to the almighty buck. It comes down to this.
And that's a challenge, I guess, for actors when they're going, oh, that person hasn't worked for a while. And well, the reason why they probably haven't worked for a while is because they're just not given that opportunity.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of little factors that come into play and stuff like that. And so that's the challenge as an actor is like, okay, when do I get given that chance so mm-hmm. I can be a part mm-hmm. of that conversation.
Well, in this day and age, you create your own opportunities.
Yes, you do. That's what you have to do.
But anyway, I just want to say that story resonated with me and still does. And now I can tell version of it, except I didn't book the one that they checked my availability. So I was hoping that would be the turning point. I could be like, oh, I'm just like Tim. But no, it wasn't.
Plenty of time. Oh, come on now.
You look great.
Oh.
No.
Stop.
Continue, please. Keep going.
Yeah.
How did you get into this business? Like, how did? Why?
Yeah,
I ask that a lot of people. Like, why do actors do this?
Why do we? Yeah. I don't know. I still ask it. That never goes away.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't.
No questioning. But then you work, and then you don't question it at mm-hmm. all.
Yeah.
And you think, I was made to do this.
Yeah.
This is what I do. So I went to college. I did plays in elementary and high school, and I went to college to play baseball and to study as well. And I realized I wasn't going to be playing much, so I stopped playing baseball and started doing plays in college, as I had done in high school and elementary. But I got a job in the business world once I graduated, and I still kept doing plays after work. And on the weekends, I found myself helping build sets for community theater.
That's cool.
And I realized this is my life. I wonder if I could make it my livelihood.
Is that when you went to Rutgers?
Yeah. And that's when I was in Syracuse, New York, and I thought, yeah, I think I got to go for it. I think I got to, as we all do, all these actors, there's that moment where you think, I'm going to go for it. Holy cow. I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to take some courses at Syracuse University, and then I'm going to audition for Rutgers. And I got in, and then before I knew it, I realized, oh, I'm an artist now. And, yeah, so that's how I got in this whole mess. My wife and I came out here in L.A. in 1995. I was doing theater, a lot of regional theater. I did Broadway, off-Broadway. And I did All My Children, which was horrendous. and not to show me in it. That's no comment on the show. It's a comment on my performance. And then I did another movie called, I can't remember, with a bunch of great guys. And it was a short. And I had to do some ADR, looping. And I remember going, I'm going to age myself because of this story. But I went and, you know, when you do ADR, as you guys know, but I'm going to tell those that are listening, you see a big screen in the studio and you've got to match your voice on the microphone. You got to match your performance in case the wind was blowing or something. So I went in to do it, and there on the screen in the stage, sound stage, was a huge close-up of mine. And I was so taken back by how awful I looked and how just the faces I saw myself making. I thought I was going to break down and cry. And so I said, I excused myself and I went down a hallway and there was a payphone. Maybe I don't have to explain to your audience what a payphone is, but there was a payphone.
Maybe the younger ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
You put money in it.
You put money in it and you make a call. This is way before cell phones. So I called my wife and I asked her, I said, are you good with how we're living right now? Because this is it. I just saw myself on a screen and there's no way I'm going to make it in film or television. I'm going to have to keep working in theater. Are you good with this? And she said, yes, you're crazy. What are you talking about? And I said, no.
You're so handsome.
No. And it was, but it was just this moment that I had. Maybe 2 years later, we're driving across the country to come to LA because I'd gotten a play up at San Francisco, the West Coast premiere of Arcadia, Tom Stoppard play. And all I could think of as we're driving across, because my wife said, no, we're going to LA. I know you can do well in LA. We're doing LA. We're both doing it. All I could think of was that big screen of my close-up the whole time we're driving across the country. And there are times when I still see close-ups and think, oh, yeah, let's get back to theater.
Yeah.
But you're marvelous. I love watching you on screen.
Oh, that's kind. You learn. It's a craft. And it's just like doing a long run in a play is a craft. I think doing work in front of a camera is a craft. Yes,
absolutely.
You can be truthful. Mm-hmm. Yes, you are working to be truthful in an imaginary circumstance, but it's craft. And you start to realize, oh, that works. If the camera's here, I think I'll do this because that would help tell the story in a better way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah. That's something that a lot of actors don't realize. I noticed this, but in fact, you know, I just got news yesterday that one of my students, she has a pin in her for something quite substantial. And I was really proud of her. Now, she's young and she's a fine actress, but she isn't quite skilled yet because she hasn't been doing theater. She hasn't been in acting school. She takes some classes. She coaches with me. But I taught her the camera, and that was the first thing I did. I was like, let's learn how to translate real life into the camera.
Yeah.
So what she's extremely skilled at is the camera.
That's great.
And so she went into this audition. It was one of her first big ones, was that I remember she was almost in tears, and she goes, I really bombed that. You know, I wasn't in the moment. I wasn't feeling it. And I said, listen, do you remember your camera technique and where to look? And she goes, yeah. And I go, then you're fine.
Teacher Ed Stern told us at Rutgers that after an audition,
go see a movie,
go do something where that's your cool. Mind is completely escaping from what you just did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like to comfort eat.
Yeah. Do whatever it takes to not think about it because it's done. It's done.
Yeah,
my son plays baseball at a pretty high level, and it's the same thing. You know, when you strike out, or if you have a bad at bat, you've got a couple innings before you might be up again. So you got a lot of time to think about it, and so you want to have something in your mind, some kind of and physically too, some kind of behavior, something that makes you say that it's done.
Yeah,
that it's done. Can't move on to it.
Can't change it.
No. They say the most important play in baseball is the next play. Mm. And I say, oh, yeah, the most important audition is the next audition.
Yeah.
Not the one you just did.
Actually, I have a trick now that I do before I go, if it's an in-room or even the students that I teach and I'm coaching them for in-room, I always put them on tape first to make it self-tape ready. And I do that for myself so that if they suck in the room or they make a mistake, not that they suck, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If they feel they suck, they have the self-tape to send to their agent or manager. And I said, and they've actually gotten them switched out and say, you know, she was just a little off, you know, she was doing this, that, or he was doing this, that.
Also gives you practice beforehand.
Yeah.
Because then it makes you know, they know exactly where where they're looking at the camera.
That's good.
Yeah, you've already done the audition,
right?
And it takes the pressure. But I've never had to do it myself because it's like that. It's almost like I have it. It's like I've got it. I've got backup.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a couple of people do it only because of nerves and everything. But then one person got it switched out.
Well, so. I think I was telling, was it Bruce that I was telling the story about Sean Penn? Like Sean Penn apparently.
No, it was Harry.
Was it Harry? Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll just say it again. Anyway, Sean Penn apparently just hated going in the rooms. And like his agency or management were like, no, go see him. He's really, really good. And they're like, okay. And he went in there and they're like, what are you talking about? He was terrible. And they're like, no, trust us. And so please just accept a self-tape from him and do a self-tape. And so they did a self-tape and...
No, you didn't tell the story at all, by the way.
Oh, really?
This wasn't to Bruce or to Harry.
Oh, well, there you go. Hey.
Good.
And he sent in a self-tape to the casting and they're like, oh my God. Cause like his agency and his manager were like, no, he's really, really good. And I think it was Fast Times.
I think
it was something like that. It was one of his early day kind of.
Where the self tapes didn't even exist then.
Yeah. And I heard another story about Vincent D'Onofrio and how he had to self tape for Full Metal Jacket. Have you heard this story at all?
No.
Oh,
no.
It's such a cool story because when he was telling it, so Stanley Kubrick reached out to him and sent him a page of writing, but it was just writing. There was no punctuation. There was no nothing. And he had to make of it what he could. And he had to put it on self-tape. And he said back then, you know, in the 70s, he had to like hire this super expensive, massive camera, all that sort of stuff, and like put it down on Beta or whatever the hell it was and send that in. And that's how I think, and then like several months later, he got the call from Kubrick to come and meet him or something like that. And that's how he got Full Metal Jacket. There might be some other stuff that I missed out on there, but I just think that's super cool.
That's a great story.
But there are no excuses nowadays, especially since everybody has a smartphone. You can, I was saying the other day how back, you know, even in 2000, I was still having to pick up my sides from my agent. It wasn't even being emailed to me. I had to go and pick it up. And if I was at work or I was doing something, then, you know, that was like three less hours I had to memorize lines. Now it's like you can just go on your iPhone, look it up. It's all there. Yep. And so there are no more excuses. If somebody bombs, they just are not prepared.
I think you can certainly bomb in an unprepared way, but you can also bomb just because.
True.
Your nerves.
You're just not right. And it's tricky because you can't cut a self-tape. You know, you can't edit it.
Mm.
There's nothing to cut back to. You can't cut to the reader. Yeah. So it's one whole pass. It's like a one-er of sorts.
It's theater.
Yeah.
In a way.
Well, kind of.
Well, I mean, yeah. But I think one of the things, because I do like self-taping and coaching as well, one of the things you notice is the rhythm. Like when, as you said, within editing, just say there's a moment where you know that they would cut back to the other character and the other character will be like reacting or having some emotional moment and then it cuts back to you. But you, like when you're watching yourself on the tape, all it is just you like watching that moment and reacting to that moment. And then it might be a bit too long.
Mm.
And so you have to kind of like bring it in and like make it a lot quicker and all that sort of stuff. Tighten it up basically. Yeah. Whereas in the actual proper production, it might be a lot longer and it'll work because I can cut to all these different things to kind of give that emotional resonance.
Unless you're doing such an amazing job, they don't cut away from you at all. Because they're like,
that's right. That is correct.
Look at that actor. This is a wonderful moment. And the director says, let's keep that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I see it in film and TV all the time. Where it's like, you feel like it should be cutting. You know, it's like they've been on this character for a very long time.
If you look at, I did a show called American Crime.
That's right.
That John Ridley wrote, and they did three seasons. I did one and there are separate stories for each season, but they're famous for staying on a certain shot that seems odd, incredibly odd. You think, even if you're not a storyteller, somewhere in your psyche, you're thinking, why don't I see the other person yet? And sometimes they'll do a whole scene where you barely see the other person. What's great about that, if it's not too conscious, is that you lean in closer, and all of a sudden you're mesmerized. And if you don't know, if you're not a storyteller, you think, something is going to happen that is unexpected, because right now I'm watching an unexpected shot. It's a device of sorts, but it works.
So one of my students, when I said that you were coming, she freaked out. She loves you. And, you know, she's seen you.
She has great taste.
She does have great taste.
Yes. Yep. We were just saying.
She has seen you in White Collar. She has seen you in Carnival. She has seen you in Seinfeld. But she freaked out. The first thing she said was,
"What were you in Seinfeld?
He was in Friends."
And Friends.
Really?
Yeah.
And she remembers all these.
Yeah. And by the way, she's young.
She is.
Yeah.
Well, Friends is on Netflix, so it's out there. It's on there.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like, this is something, I mean, you would have to really have to binge watch that. I mean,
she's 25 to know
she's
that.
She's 25.
So she has great taste.
And she told me the exact episode.
No. Oh my God.
Ooh. You know, the one where Rachel's in the hospital, and was it Rachel in the hospital, right? Somebody was in the hospital having
Rachel
a baby.
Rachel was having a baby.
And she said verbatim, your lines.
Wow.
Oh.
She's a super Friends fan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Give her a shout out to Namu Maraputi.
Namu Maraputi.
Namu Maraputi.
Namu Maraputi.
Yeah. Tell
Thank you so much.
You have great taste.
Yes. Hi.
She would die to meet you if she was here.
I hope we can meet someday.
Well, I will arrange that.
Wonderful.
Boom. No, it's pressure now.
Yeah.
I do feel that palpitation.
What was the Seinfeld?
Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Get this, 1997.
Yeah. Damn.
That's how long ago it was. Seinfeld, I played a boyfriend of Elaine's an episode where.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was, I was part of the stable of boyfriends of hers.
And what was your problem?
my name is Kevin, and I.
You remember your name there?
I'll tell you why. In a minute. I overheard her saying that there were too many babies in the world. And I turned around. We were at a bookstore. This dates the show as well. And I agreed with her. And then, we struck up a romantic relationship. And I ended up getting a vasectomy.
Oh.
And then she cut her hair really short. And I liked it short. Just crazy Seinfeld stuff.
Yeah.
But what was really cool was halfway through the episode, we're filming and rehearsing. You filmed a lot of this stuff prior to an audience of Seinfeld because it was a lot of
outdoor stuff
on the New York street, exteriors. Anyway, so Jerry comes up to me and he says, Tim, you want to do the next episode? I said, yeah.
Please.
He said, here's the script. And I read it, and it was the Bizarro Jerry episode, which is a pretty well-known episode where my character has two friends named Gene and Feldman. They're like George and Kramer, and Elaine can't decide who to hang out with.
Yeah, yeah. I think I remember elements of that, yeah.
But what was cool was that I read it, and I had just gotten an offer to do a show called Fire Company 123, short-lived, hour-long drama. And I told Jerry, I said, "Oh, Jerry, I'm working next week, but I really want to do this." And he said, "Who do I call?"
Oh.
And it was just,
no.
Yeah. And I said, I don't know. I'll call my agent. Their UPM unit production manager worked it out with Fire Company 123s, and I was able to do both. And it was just one of those magical weeks. Yeah.
So well done you. So how did you remember your name?
Power of Jerry.
Because it was Brian, and we had to change it to Kevin because they wanted to call me Kevin in the next episode, and there was a big talk about it. So,
oh, okay.
For some reason, I remember that.
Well, I mean, I guess the fact that Jerry Seinfeld went into bat for you is a pretty big moment for you to remember what to do.
Who do I call?
Were they wonderful to work with? I hear Julia Louis-Dreyfus is a genius.
She's great. And we kind of stayed in touch, and I ended up doing three episodes as a recurring boyfriend as well
on
New Adventures of Old Christine.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. So she brought you in for that. She remembered you and she brought you in?
She just said, call Tim Decay and offer it to him and tell him to come in and play my boyfriend.
Oh, man.
Boom.
Boom. Oh, yeah. See, that's like the ultimate gold when it comes to an actor, is one of those scenarios.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been, you know, now that, you know, because after I met you, I mean, you've been working really consistently, and it's kind of hard to have friends that way. Well, we've stayed friends, but I just remember, I was like, I don't see Tim anymore.
Well, White Collar was shot in New York, I was there for 6 years.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But then you came back and you went on to do Second Chance?
Second Chance, yeah. Which shot in Vancouver. I was there for a year. I love that city. I love New York. I love L.A., yeah.
Nothing shoots in L.A. anymore.
No.
Anyway, so.
But Vancouver, you have to go. It's a great city.
I've heard. That is definitely a place where I'd like to go. And
Toronto as well. Really nice. I know Vancouver and Toronto, there's so much shooting there. So much.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
Vancouver is much more easier to get to and fro because Vancouver is, you know, it's far. But or Toronto is far, but Vancouver is just a super city.
So how does that work with, you know, son, daughter, wife, you know, being away for long stretches? Do they come with you? Does Lisa come with you? I mean, what happens?
No, when I go on location, I take off my ring and I put it on the dresser and I say, kids, I'll be back. Honey, I promise. It's just easier this way. You make it work. When I shot White Collar, I flew back every weekend. Oh. And then once their sports and camps were done in the summer, they would come join me. But we only shot White Collar for 6 months because there's only 16 episodes a season. So we got it done in 6 months. But in five of those months, I flew back and forth most every weekend. And then in August, they would come live with me in New York City.
Did that take it out of you, the constant travel?
I think it did.
Yeah.
I think I lost years, but not then.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like I'm catching up on them now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it did, but here's the thing. I'd get on the plane Saturday morning excited to see my family.
Yeah.
And Sunday night, I'd get back on the plane in LA to come to New York, and I'd be sad to leave them.
But excited to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was never a grind.
Yeah.
You know?
No, fair enough.
So I think probably physically it did a toll on me, but so worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I know you were saying, because I'd forgotten about this, that Lisa, you guys met at Rutgers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So, and you stayed, but how much has she sort of had to sacrifice her own career to raise?
She's had to sacrifice a lot. Yeah. Because she was, the first few years we were married, she's beautiful. And she did a number of soaps, and she had a very successful career with commercials. And so she made the money, and I was off getting not much money doing regional theater. But then, as you said, once we had kids, somebody needed to stay home. Somebody needed to, raise them. And she worked a little bit. She did a King of Queens, and she was nursing Dana at the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's tough. If you're the star of a show or a movie, you can do it because you've got a team behind you helping you. But when you're guest starring on that, and then she guest starred with me on Everwood for a couple episodes, it's difficult when they're young. now that they're off, now our son is going to be off this fall and our daughter in a couple years, now she's starting to think, well, do I want to go back and act? What do I want to do? Mm. It's a sacrifice. But she's the best mom in the world, and she loves that job, and never once resented it.
No, I mean, I've given up a couple times for boys in the course of my career, and I don't have any regrets at all.
I think you have to. Mm. I think unless...
You have to have regrets?
No, you don't have to have regrets. I think you have to give up every so often for a personal relationship, whether it's a family, whether it's your partner or your wife or your husband, whatever term you want to put, you have to. If you don't, at least every person I've come into play with and come into contact with, if you don't, it takes you down a bad path and
imbalance.
Imbalance, and maybe your career will be better, but you're going to be a different kind of person.
Like something's missing, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And maybe you're okay with that missing.
Yeah.
We saw Pavarotti.
Hmm. Wicked.
The Ron Howard documentary.
Mm.
Just saw it. And he's, at the beginning, he's this family man and he's great, but he has two torrid affairs. One where he ends up having a child, and both of the women were much younger than him. And I'm watching it and I'm thinking, I wonder if he didn't have it. I wonder if that wasn't in his life, would he still have, would his wings gone as wide?
Mm.
Would he have been Pavarotti?
Oh, okay, I get you.
You know what I mean?
Would
he not have been? Would he have not been able to, not to say that the affairs or that private life was the reason that he was, certainly the affairs were not the reason he was Pavarotti, but that private life of just saying, see a family. You know, and separating, I don't know if he would have spread his wings as wide.
No.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
It reminds me of the movie Whiplash when Miles Teller dumps his girlfriend because he just wants to focus on drumming and he doesn't want to worry about having to message her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know a story. The actor Joel Edgerton, I read an interview with him, and he made the sacrifice of breaking up with his fiance to fully focus on acting. And I mean, his career's been going gangbusters.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a pretty interesting kind of, you know, like sacrifice and thing to make, sort of stuff. So
yeah, it's a dance.
Yeah. And it is a dance because, like, this industry it's a brutal industry when it comes to relationships and things like that. Like it's crazy. The amount of travel, as you said, the amount of travel that you have to do, the fact that there could be periods of time where you're not doing anything or you're not working.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a job that takes you to South Africa or takes you to Europe or something like that. I remember another interview with Matt Damon, and he was talking about sitting down. He's like, I got to sit down and think about movies for the summer. And his wife goes, if you don't take some time off and hang with your family, you're going to be on your own. And he's like, all right, okay, looks like I'll be doing that.
Yeah.
hanging with my family.
And that's wonderful when you can take time off. But there are a lot of us
who cannot. Yep.
You know, or you can't take a whole summer off. You can take some time off. But eventually, both the artist in you and the provider in you says, I need to work.
Yeah.
It's constant balance, constant. Will Gear, do you know who Will Gear was? He played Grandpa in The Waltons, and he was a wonderful actor and did a lot of theater. He was on his deathbed. This is a story. And somebody said, Will, you've had a great career as an actor, et cetera. was it all worth it? You know, all the trials and tribulations you've had to be the known actor you are. And on his deathbed, he said, I don't know.
I guess you probably, like, would, yeah.
I don't know. Who knows? I guess it was worth it. Yeah. I don't know. What I didn't do anything else. I, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, I didn't
do anything else, so.
I wasn't an astrophysicist or a vet or something like that. Yeah, right. Yeah. It is interesting, the paths that we choose. Mm. Yeah, I mean, like, I think we spoke the other day, like, what would we do if we weren't doing this? And I'd be like, I would love to be a rock star. But it's
you
still,
would?
Yeah, oh hell yeah.
Yeah, I said that too. Yeah.
Do you play guitar?
No, I have no musical talent in my body.
But yeah, you want to be a rock star.
Oh, yeah, it's just, what it is just, I love watching live performances, especially from, like, you know, I love heavy metal and rock and roll and all that sort of stuff. And it just gets me so pumped up.
It does.
Yeah, and just imagining just you creating something and going up and standing in front of like 30, 40, 50,000 people and just them all screaming. It'd be just like,
oh. Euphoria.
Yeah, it would be.
It's religious.
Yeah, absolutely. And the closest that I got, like I feel to that is, you know, doing theater.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, obviously it's not in front of, you know, 50,000 or, you know, 100,000 screaming fans, but you going out and bearing your soul.
Yeah.
And having the audience come along with you for the ride.
Right.
Is such a thrill. Like when it's flowing, it's such a buzz.
It is. It is. Yeah, it's precarious.
Mm. Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that would be me. I mean, when I first actually got into acting, I was studying to be a vet.
Oh.
Yeah. I was studying like the initial course to get into vet science. And I was at college. This is an actor's origin story for me. 6 months into college, I just realized I'm like, I'm not taking this seriously. I'm partying. I'm chasing girls. I'm, you know, drinking. And
who are you kidding? You still do that, Dan?
Oh, stop it. I'm a mature man now. And I realized that I can't stay in a room and study. It just wasn't me.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so I took 6 months off. I did a bit of work. And then I was over at my friend Michael Lucas's place. And I was watching Varsity Blues.
Oh, that's funny.
Watching Varsity Blues. And there's one like montage-y segment where they're playing football. And Foo Fighters, My Hero comes on. And I got such a like tingling kind of buzz of like, and just imagining myself, like how proud I would be, like being in something like that and like my family being proud and everything like that. And I was like, yes, I want to be an actor because like in the like early days, I did theater and like at school and all that sort of stuff. And I was very creative that way. And so I auditioned for the acting school, QUT in Brisbane, and I got it. And you know, I didn't know what I was doing when like with auditioning for acting. I was, I think, 18 years old, 17, 18 years old. And I learned the scenes and just did it in the mirror and go, okay, at this point here, I'll pretend to do this. And this part here, I'll do this and I'll do this. Yeah. But, and then it kind of like, they could see that there was something kind of there.
Sure.
And I got in and the rest is history. And I guess, you know, I'm still figuring it out.
So this is when you were 18?
Yeah, 17, 18 years old. I think I was 18. Yeah. Yeah, 18. Yeah, I turned 18. Yep. Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So I've been doing it since then.
Well, but that's what we do.
Yeah. But
that's,
even now,
that's a great story because
I love it because I'm like, oh, I actually had a light bulb moment.
Saw a production of Lear and I knew, or saw a Hamlet at the old Vic.
No,
Blues.
Yeah, no, this is James Van Der Beek. This is Paul Walker.
this is a montage.
I mean, I love that movie. Like that movie, every time it comes on, I watch it because it's such an important part.
Of course.
Yeah, of it. And it's fun. And that's my origin story.
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that the other person who was inspired by some chick, doesn't matter.
Nope.
It just all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, this is it.
I got it.
It had such a visceral reaction in my body that I was like, ooh, I have to follow this.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important thing for like anything. If you have such a positive kind of, it's like, it's like either you, the universe or your subconscious or whatever it is going, do that, go do that. And I kind of feel like you need to trust yourself in those situations. Completely. And stuff like that. Unless you're on like drugs and telling you to like jump off something.
Yeah.
Then don't do that. That's just silly. Don't do drugs, kids.
Don't do drugs. Yeah.
No.
What did Bill Nye say? It's like, don't, and Love Actually, don't buy drugs.
Yeah.
Become a rock star.
And you'll get them for free.
One of the best quotes.
Oh, man. He's so good. I worked with him actually briefly.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, just briefly. So there was this movie that I did called Heidi Queen of the Mountain. Never came out, will never come out.
Oh, I remember this. I remember you saying.
But we went and shot in Spain, some of the scenes, and it was so beautiful. Mm. Absolutely phenomenal. but there were so many problems with that production, so many. But Bill was there, we were doing scenes with Bill, and he's so theatrical, like at this point, he'll stand at this point and then he'll turn exactly at this particular point. And it, like, it's very, very structured. And it was just amazing watching him work and stuff like that.
I've seen a lot of actors do that. I've watched it where they choreograph something and they do it the same way every time.
Yeah.
Where the words fall after, you're cutting meat.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, cutting meat says the word, you know, spreading butter on toast. And I remember just seeing him.
Continuity must love them.
Well, yeah. But it's another camera thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I was taught in drama school, and my, you know, head of acting, and she said, if you want to be a film, and we were all there actually to learn. We didn't have on-camera classes. It was, you know, it's England. It's the land of Shakespeare.
Yeah, and so bard.
Yeah, and a lot of us, including myself, I wanted to join the RSC. That was my dream. I didn't care if I ever did film or TV. It was just, I loved Shakespeare so much. I remember her saying this, but I didn't put any stock into it because I thought to myself, that's not what I want to do. I'm never going to go to Los Angeles. I'm going to live here in England and I'm going to be Stratford-upon-Avon.
Yeah.
But I remember she goes, if you want to be a film actor, to be a good film actor, you have to be a good technician.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she goes, and you know, of course, we were taught to be real and authentic, but that was, she said, it is not like theater at all.
Yeah, we were talking about that, I think, earlier about craft and how you have learned. You learn each time and you realize what works and what doesn't work.
Because we're talking about continuity, that's editing. I mean, let's put it, camera is not an actor's medium. And I hear this said a lot. It is, theater is an actor's medium. I think it's the editor and the director who film is really for.
Yeah. Well, that's what David Mamet says. He said the movie is made in the editing suite.
Yeah. And so continuity, that helps, you know, with the post.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, I remember the last film I did. I mean, because everything costs money. And I knew my mark. And I just overshot it by a fraction. And we did the scene, but then for them to set it all up all over again, I mean, it takes a few minutes to reset a shot.
Yeah.
And I remember they said, you just stepped past your mark just a little bit and you were in front of the other actor. And we heard, and I was humiliated.
Yeah. You blocked their light or whatever.
I did. And I just thought to myself, oh, how horrible.
I'm terrible.
No, I was. It was the first shot that I was for the film, my first day, and I was embarrassed.
You would have learned from there.
You
wouldn't do it again. I mean, you probably will, like, just accidentally, because things happen.
I did it accidentally. That's the thing, because I saw it in my eye. I saw the mark.
Yeah.
But I think that was just, it was nerves.
And no, it was practice. I know Heath Ledger was a stickler for that kind of thing. Like, you know, the scene when he comes out of the hospital in Dark Knight, and he, like, blows up, he would count the exact amount of steps. He'd know exactly when he would turn. He would know exactly with this and this and this and all that sort of stuff and just work with the camera. And you know, once again, doing the self-taping and coaching thing, you see it on screen. And I always tell the actors, all right, I might tell you to do this and do that. It may feel weird and unorganic, but it just tells the story and looks good on camera.
Oh, yeah, much more.
I tell people
and then
that
they look
too.
At it and go, oh, okay, I get what you mean.
I have people say, it just feels so robotic and mechanical. And I said, yes, but it doesn't look it. It will feel robotic and mechanical.
Yeah.
And that's normal. because sometimes what you're feeling doesn't translate. And I noticed that from the first film I did. I just come back from drama school and I thought I was doing a great job. I was feeling in the moment. And when I saw it at Sundance, I remember thinking, that is not what I thought I did.
No. Yeah, that happens. Yeah. And what's interesting is when you do a series and you're shooting day in, day out, you start to do this. You start to say, you know, if I don't cross to the desk and we stay here, it's just as powerful and we'll be out at this location 40 minutes sooner than if I cross to the desk and then we can get to the other shot. And you start thinking that way because everybody thinks that way when you're shooting a TV show.
Yeah.
Because as you said, it's about the money. So you start, you can't help it because as actors, we're receptive, we're open to that. Mm. And so we're aware of what is needed sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. So you just start doing tricks like
did
that.
You, did you start thinking about that from an actor's perspective? Because you also directed White Collar.
Yeah, I directed three episodes. Yeah.
And so how, because I know directors definitely think like that. But so did you, was that before or after you directed?
It was a little bit before. Certainly after I directed, I was, you know, even more aware, but I've directed theater a lot prior to that. But doing the episodes of White Collar was, it was a lesson on, I remember driving up and seeing all the wagons and everything. We were shooting at Yankee Stadium and I thought, oh my, I can't do this. I can't do this. This is too much. And I shared that with a prop guy who's good friends with me at the time. He said, oh, just stick with what you know. And, oh, yep. Okay, good.
I love that.
Yeah.
And the wise prop guy.
Yeah, stick with what you know. And so I let the other departments do what they do, communicate with them what you want.
Mm.
And it worked out.
And you'd probably seen enough of how everybody all functioned and worked together to kind of go, okay, I remember that director did that, so I'm just going to do that and
yeah.
all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah. Oh, did you shadow for a while before you started directing, or did you just were like, I want to do this?
Was it something you'd been thinking about that you want to direct someday? I know you said you were directing theater.
It had been something, not hugely so. It was part of a mix-up of, not a mix-up of, it came into play when we renegotiated my being able to direct an episode a season. So
Do they pay you a director's fee, or is that all part of your contract?
They did. It's an extra fee. And I think because it has to be through the union.
Yeah,
well,
okay, fair enough. Yep, yep, yep.
And you also became a producer on that. So was that part of the contract as well?
Yeah.
Matt
and I became producers because we had really, from the beginning, been a big part of just developing the characters and having an input. Jeff Easton was so open, who created White Collar, was so open to our suggestions. And I wouldn't say, oh, what if we had told this episode or did this story? But it was more of a storytelling from our character's point of view. So they gave us some producer credits, which was really nice. What was I going to say?
We were talking about directing, if that was something you wanted to do.
Yeah, but we were directing...
I'm sorry.
Yankee Stadium.
I can't remember.
Props guy.
Do what you know.
Do what you know. Oh, darn it. I'll think of it.
Tomorrow you're like, oh, and text.
That was it.
Text.
We'll just add it in post.
Yes, we'll add it in post.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We'll have you call. So how was working with Matt?
Yeah.
Oh,
because you guys had a great chemistry.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
We did, and we had it off screen as well, and we're still quite close. His kids go to my kid's school, and Matt is young enough to be the, you know, gorgeous, good looking, and talented and funny actor that he is, but he's also not too young to realize when we had White Collar, oh, this is a good thing, oh, we're so lucky. This is great.
Yeah.
So there was never once took advantage of the fact or made light of the fact that we had a show going.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I've heard stories of friends who have worked on big productions and they've got a very young lead who,
yeah.
and they're just like, they're so, they don't know what they've got.
No,
they're
they
not
don't.
Appreciative.
They're not appreciative. They I wouldn't say ungrateful, but just their behavior.
Take it for granted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Take it for granted because they're getting paid a fortune compared to like veteran actors who have been around the bush, like on the show doing a much smaller part, who know, you know, probably know so much more.
That's right.
But, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
The struggle is real, folks.
It is.
It's very real, guys. It's a common theme among our podcast right now.
but working with Matt was terrific. And Willie and Tiffany and Marsha and Sharif and everybody who's on the show. We had a great love for each other and a great respect for each other. I know what I was going to say now.
Yeah, there we go.
The difficult thing about directing a show that you're in, it's not directing a scene you're in, because I'd set up the shots and then I'd go be in the scene and we'd finish it and I'd look to Matt or Willie or whomever was in, Tiffany, whoever was in the scene with me. I'd say, what do you think? And they'd say, yeah, do it again. I think maybe you might want to hear at this moment or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Okay, we're going to go again.
It's a very collaborative kind of a thing.
So collaborative. Yeah. But the week before you film in television, you do prep, you scout locations, you do so that was very difficult to be acting in the current episode.
Oh yeah,
then
yeah.
Then having to go scout, having to go to casting to cast people in it and still be in a show and still be in the episode. That was a little crazy. But
you do it again.
Oh, in a second. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Do you have any aspirations for like having your own show, as in like you create your own show, like writing and things like that, or it's your ideas and then somebody else writes it? Or?
I'm working on something now with somebody.
Nice.
And I think it's pretty good. It's a reboot of something.
Ooh.
Which I'm not allowed to say, but
that's okay.
But you can tell us when the mics are off.
Yeah, when the mics are off, you can tell us.
But I can't write. No. I wish I could, but a blank piece of paper is just, in an hour, it will be a blank piece of paper. And so, but I can
with a question
analyze,
mark on it.
Yes. but I can analyze a script and get us communicate what I need or what we need in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always thinking about, I love the idea of a one-person show.
Like television show or theater?
Theater.
Yeah.
So I'm working with a buddy of mine, Doug Savant, on something now.
Oh, Doug Savant, of course.
Yeah, for him to do a one-person show. I like that idea. And I like the idea of that I'm working on. You know the play Masterclass?
Yes.
It was basically based on Maria Callas, and this woman was giving a masterclass on opera, and she was able to bring up the singers from the audience who were in the class, and it's a great play. I would love to do that but have it be a baseball lesson, a lesson on hitting. So
is that now?
Well, there's nothing stopping you.
So you played baseball, you played college ball, and then
very little.
But then you also played an ex-ball player on Carnival. I thought was perfect. But is that the reason why your son James got interested in baseball, or is it?
I think so. He started playing when he was 4 or 5, and he was good. And so, he started traveling, and just like any youth sport now, there is a money making machine for you to take your kid and go every weekend to some tournament. So. But he's, as my dad said, he's far better than you ever were.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, but he is. Yeah.
So does he want, do you think he'll want to go pro after?
He would like to. Well, I think most kids his age want to do that. But as you get older, you start to realize, this is where I fall.
Mm.
This is what it's going to take to continue.
Yeah.
Like your brother in volleyball.
Yeah.
It takes a lot.
Yeah. Well, his was a relationship that ended. And he realized that he was like, I think I was just doing it for her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. But he was damn good. He was really good.
Sure.
Yeah. And and then when he found that out, he was like, not for me.
Done.
And just done. Yeah. Good, and that's a long period of his life was dedicated to that.
And for a physically oriented path, there is that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
We're lucky. We can keep working until we croak.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. But athletes, there is that moment.
And dancers, they have a life expectancy.
And dancers, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
All of a sudden, you just have to say, that's it.
Yeah.
It's not fun anymore. I'm done.
Yeah.
I was, in fact, you know them. You know the Steppen twins.
Yes,
Karen and they worked with you, and of course they Karen was my aerial coach. So Karen Stebb and I were very close.
That's fantastic.
I know. So, but I remember she was only in her 30s, and she was saying that she was getting out of bed and she felt like she was 70 every morning because it had taken so much out of her. And what's funny is she never really wanted to. The Stebb and twins did Cirque du Soleil for 16 years. They were, they're still amazing.
Yeah, I think
they still do it.
That just would be brutal on the body.
Right.
But Karen never wanted, she did it because of her twin sister, Sarah.
Okay.
And so Karen really wanted to be a nurse. She never wanted to be in the public eye, and she did it for her sister. Yeah, and then at some point, she just felt it got too late.
Yeah.
But I just...
To be a nurse?
She has...
Or to get out.
To get out.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Okay.
No, it's true. It's just... my son is... He's in physical therapy right now for his arm. It's just... There's always something.
Yeah.
Something is hurting. Yeah.
I don't think I want to be 50 and be like, oh, I feel
my,
like I'm
my 80. Body hurts enough and not doing any of that stuff.
I was just, well, you're young. I feel the same way. I think, oh my gosh, I've got to make sure I don't get up from the chair that slowly the next time I have a big meeting with somebody, because they're going to think, my God, Decay.
What was all that noise?
He cracked. Did you hear him?
Yeah.
It was crunching.
It reminds me of the Billy Connolly. With Billy Connolly, he has a skit where he says, you know, you're something about getting older when your body makes an orchestra of noises. You bend down.
When you get up, yeah.
Crack, crack. Ooh. Jesus Christ.
Whenever I bend down, my knees pop. When I walk upstairs, my right ankle goes like click, 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 click. And like I'm 37. And like when you look at professional athletes, like around 30, 31 is when maybe things start to happen. And so I'm like, oh man, like I'm way beyond that. I mean, there are a couple of like, volleyball players. Cause I guess it's strenuous volleyball, but it's not the massive impact or they don't play as much as say baseball does, which is
there's no contact.
Yeah.
For one.
Yeah. And that's a big part. And I think as well, that's why I say like NBA players can play. I think some of them are like almost 40. They can play because
they can play longer than a football player.
Yeah.
Because, American football.
Exactly. Or
rugby.
Rugby league. Like I think the oldest player in rugby league might be turning actually a year older than me.
Yeah.
And he's one of those rare.
Sure.
Kind of like players that can, but he's giving it up this year.
He is.
And you always hear from a lot of the players, they talk about how, they get up the next day and it's just, it's a lot harder to recover. You know, it's just like, you know, all of us, I'm assuming now, whenever, if we get super drunk, the next 3 days it takes you to recover. You know, it's not like, you know, you get up at 4 a.m., 8 a.m. the next morning, you're like, oh man, I feel like crap. And then an hour later, you're like, all right, I'm fine. Let's go. Let's go again.
Well, yep. I don't drink.
Oh,
so,
no, okay.
I will say when I have a night of insomnia or something, I, you know, in the old days I could recover without any sleep. And now it just, days later, I'm still tired.
I'm sure.
I need I had a nap before. I need my, and I only had like 6.5 hours sleep. I need my eight. And sometimes it's very hard for me to get eight. But once I get eight, I'm like, yes. But if I'm less than that, I'm like, one more thing.
I have my mind doesn't stop. It just keeps on going. I could be exhausted, but if my mind is going, there's no way I can stop.
Do you take anything?
Yes.
Tell us, Romy. Tell us.
Is this going to be edited out?
I don't see that as a problem. We're in LA.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's legal. You know, but, you know, but the only thing that'll actually make me sleep are edibles.
Yeah.
Oh, they do.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody listening was like, oh, what does she take? Edibles. Oh, okay. Yeah, I do that.
Yeah, right.
Everybody does.
Well, no, I still, you know, I'm still part of another generation where it was illegal. So I'm still getting used to this whole legal thing.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal anymore, but
But those help.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Do you feel refreshed the next day?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do?
I'm fine. For other people, I've heard not the case.
Yeah.
But if I take things like Tylenol, PM, Aleve PM, yeah, that knocks me out and I'll be gone. I can't smoke. Because I will still feel groggy. But edibles after a certain period is just out of my system. Yeah.
I know. I feel wonderful. For me, routine.
And I'm a foodie, so it tastes good.
Tastes good, yeah.
Blueberry blast. Whew. Covered in chocolate.
I need familiar. Like whenever I go back to my own bed, boom, I will sleep like a baby.
Oh,
it's that familiar kind of environment and things like that. Even if there's noise all around, because I'm in my own bed, it's fine. And also, I think you were saying the other day or just before, if I know I've got something that I have to get up for that's a little bit out of my routine, it's super hard for me to get some sleep, or I'll wake up super early and just can't get back to sleep.
Because you're nervous about it.
Or just like, oh, I want to get more sleep in. That obligation of wanting to get more sleep just completely wakes my brain up.
First night before first day of shooting is always difficult for me.
Oh, yeah? Do you take anything?
Oh, sometimes I'll take melatonin.
You can put it under your tongue now. It used to be just pill form.
There
but
are
now
gummies. Yeah. Ooh. I'll take melatonin. Or but I would never take edibles. I mean, I can't stand the people who take edibles.
Hey, everybody. Apologies for the podcast ending early. We had a few technical difficulties, but Tim Decay will be back next week for part two. So thanks very much for listening. We appreciate your support. And Romy and Dan out.